Okay, thank you very much, Henry, for the invitation. Thank you all very much for being here. I want to talk about mice. And this sort of leads me to a little bit of an apology because many of you have heard me talk about these creatures before. I've been studying lab mice for the last few years, exploring their emerging biogeographies internationally and in all their genetically diverse forms, through the changing ways they're being created, used, circulated, and now at times replaced in the laboratories of biomedical research. But I can't really apologise for coming back to them today. The scale of these creatures, after all, is my price of admission to the event, but of course only just. Here, as elsewhere, they're truly liminal animals. And in fact, when Henry first asked me to talk, I had to point out that in the strictest sense, a mouse cannot be smaller than a mouse. So, you know, I'm slightly here under false pretenses. This began to question my inclusion in this event and this coterie of creatures that I've been thinking with for some years. But if you replace smaller than with this symbol, which those of you who remember back to your mathematics means smaller than or equivalent to, a whole series of other issues come into scope, particularly around how we perform and think about this notion of equivalence. And I've got two of these genetically altered animals as well to kind of point out that quite how big a mouse isn't always very obvious in the first place. What a mouse is equivalent to or smaller than points to key tensions in the use of animals in biomedical research and the operation of scale in terms of size, evolutionary history, and also forms of measurement. I've identified two of these in my abstract. The first is the process whereby an animal is seen as both similar enough to humans to be a valid model for human biological processes and different enough for the process of experimentation to be considered both practicable and ethical. An exploration of how scale operates in assembling mice as an experimental model for humans is the first argument about equivalence that I want to explore. Here we find small animals at the centre of large experimental systems, which are organised to explore small molecular differences with potentially large biological effects. In these systems, as I've said, it's not always possible to say quite how big a mouse actually is. There are questions around the properties of their individual bodies, but there's also questions about how these properties are extended over space and over time through the form of the internationally distributed inbred strain. Scale then is complex, but for science, size certainly matters. The second tension, here we've got the kind of reversal, what might be smaller than a mouse and thinking about the relevance of species scales in relation to sentience. This second tension then relates to how assessments of ethical experimentation are being made and changing, and the ways in which species difference is being brought into debates about the three R's. That's the replacement, reduction, and refinement of animal research. The growing numbers of mice used in biomedical research and a growing disquiet of this continuing upward trend has brought out arguments about other ways of thinking about equivalence. What's the valid way of replacing the burden on mice through refining procedures or replacing them, perhaps, with another species? This media story is an interesting one. It identifies the growing use of laboratory animals from a low point in the 1990s to a peak in this article in 2012, although this increase is still ongoing. The figures are reported annually in the UK and they get very similar media coverage each year. This story, though, is a little bit different. It reports the UK coalition government's commitment to reducing this number. And also, exceptionally, it illustrates the news report not with a picture of mice, but with a picture of zebrafish. Their use is increasing rapidly, especially in genetics, where they're replacing mice. But there are growing questions over fish welfare and whether this is genuinely a refinement or merely a shift in this burden. It also raises the converse question of what and in what context, if I'm allowed to bring the name of a larger species into this, when might a rat actually constitute a better replacement species than a mouse in terms of animal welfare? How scale matters to the rhetoric and practices of replacement in animal research is also turning out not just to be a matter of academic reflection for me, but also a key question in the work that I'm doing on the UK Animals and Science Committee, where we're trying to make sense of some of these debates. There's then a third way in which equivalence and mice feature in my research and in my thinking. And this is through narrative and imagery. As well as populating our laboratories, mice have also colonized our imaginations. Mice feature frequently in fables and are illustrated liberally in both the semiotic forms of translational science and the tropes of imaginative literature. The animals, the individual animal resident in both cases with a wider meaning. And here's one from Lewis Carroll. You probably can't read it out, and I still haven't quite decided whether I should read you a poem from Lewis Carroll out at the beginning of this, but I'm kind of thinking I will. So this what it is, it's a fourfold pun. It's a tale which is about a tale in the shape of a tale and the form of a tale rhyme. And this is how it goes. Fury said to a mouse that he met in the house, let us both go to law, I will prosecute you. Come, I'll take no denial, we must have the trial, for really this morning I've nothing to do. Said the mouse to the cur, such a trial, dear sir, with no jury or judge would be wasting our breath. I'll be judge, I'll be jury, said cunning old Fury, I'll try the whole case and condemn you to death. It has to be said that fables for mice never tend to end well. As in experimental procedures, they frequently find themselves in this subject position, being judged in apparently absurd trials that have little meaning for them. What lands them in the lab and the dock is their apparently uncontrollable appetites for both food and for sex, rapidly breeding and rapaciously consuming. That is their capacity for excess. As in the tail rhyme, which is the form of this rhyming couplet, and then the additional rhyme which is picked up later on, there's always this excess or supplement in mice, which humans struggle to control and channel. Occasionally their agency can be recuperated. If you know Aesop's fable of the mouse and the lion, they can come back and gnaw through knotty problems. So I'm hoping to kind of bring some of these abilities of these excessive but also gnawing capabilities of mice to think through some more formal reflections on experimental systems of scales of mouse research. And I want to turn to a fable that kind of has exploded in the worlds of mice research, which is the work on the mouse grimace scale. So this is the mouse grimace scale. And the story here starts with the work of Geoffrey McGill and colleagues at the Pain Genetics Lab at McGill University, searching for a better mouse model to help their work on understanding chronic pain disorders in humans. And this was a controversial experiment from the beginning. All research using animals in labs is meant to reduce suffering as far as is experimentally feasible. To examine pain requires inflicting pain. But more than this, it raises questions about how do you measure pain in mice in ways that make it meaningful for treating human disorders. You can't ask the mouse if what they're feeling, so you have to inflict it and find a way to measure it. Models of pain are traditionally based on avoidance behaviours in different animals. Behaviour is measurable and it can be linked to a specific experience. So, for example, you put an animal on a hot plate, slowly heat the hot plate, and measure the time it takes for the mouse to jump off, registering an aversive stimuli, experience of pain, or nociception. Through this and other methods, a series of genetically altered mice, which have been bred to allow experimenters to study particular molecular pathways, can have their responses measured, and it begins to indicate what the next steps towards new biological insights and genetic mechanisms of pain in humans might actually be. That's the idea of it. But researchers have always acknowledged that this was a very limited model, particularly for chronic pain that tends to affect humans. They know animals feel different kinds of pain, and pain release is increasingly used prophylactically after mouse surgeries. But questions still remain. How do we know the mouse felt pain, and how could you measure it experimentally? And this group of researchers began adopting and adapting a scale used to measure pain in human infants. The researchers started looking at the facial expressions of mice. They monitored animals which were subject to painful interventions from cutting skin to damaging nerves, and then were also subject to different doses of analgesia. Through videoing the after effects on large number of animals and blind coding for animal expressions, they started to identify patterns which they thought were linked to pain. Grouping these facial expressions into different levels of severity, cross-checking these across the different doses of analgesia and other biomarkers of pain, and you get the mouse grimace scale. So you can see here there are five main characteristics: orbital tightening, which is squeezing around the eyes, nose bulge, cheek bulge, the ear position, and the change in whiskers. The research made big news very quickly. First, there was criticism. To have deliberately caused pain in mice was controversial. And there's some quite graphic descriptions in here about immersing the tail in hot water, putting binder clips on tails, cutting paws, injecting chemicals into paws and stomach, that actually made a lot of people very uncomfortable. So you can see why this might have been quite controversial. But more than this, the paper used a reporting category of severe on the mouse grimace scale, which is a technical language in most regulation which is used to define the limits of what's acceptable under regulation. So there's a kind of mix between concern about protocols but also concerns about severity. This prompted an institutional ethical review to ensure that correct procedures had been followed. It was agreed that whilst difficult work, the work was scientifically justified and that different meanings of severity were being used. So in this instance, it did come within the institutional definition of ethical research. From this kind of controversial beginning, the narrative of the work begins to change. You could say it jumps scale. The research began to be explored for the different ways it could demonstrate how mice were smaller than but equivalent to humans, in an evolutionary way, in an effective way, and in an ethical way. This exchange of painful glances and its demonstration of evolutionary histories, shared effects, had the potential, many people thought, to change the ethical status of mice. The implications of the mouse grimace scale apparently became totally unbounded. And I've pulled this up, it's from a Wired magazine, which is, you know, it's kind of popular science. And in the second part of the paragraph of the article, it just begins to kind of radiate out in all directions. You go from Darwin, we go back to the 1872 book on the expressions of emotion in man and animals, we get this psychologist at University College London who talks about evolutionary hardwiring of facial expressions. You get links to the work of studies of tribes in Papua New Guinea, and then we kind of come on to farming practices. There's nowhere that this doesn't suddenly travel. And the research becomes rapidly accepted by biomedical scientists and animal welfare researchers who propose this not only as the future of modelling pain in humans, but also the future of animal welfare modelling. A rabbit grimace scale, a rat grimace scale, and now a horse grimace scale are all being developed. And then there was a final iteration of this research. The mouse grimace scale was also used to show that pain expressions and potentially all other research on mice were influenced by the gender of the researcher. And I have to say, this is the mouse story that's probably most frequently been emailed and tweeted to me in all the years that I've been doing this work. People say this is something they sort of suspected. Cultural geographers, feminist science studies love this story, and it kind of came in at one point roughly once a week. What they thought and what they knew, apparently validated by one experiment in the mouse grimace scale. And I fully expect this work to circulate further. If you want to push it theoretically, there are echoes here of Donna Haraway's provocation of exploring shared suffering, and so on. And I must admit, a year ago, I would have probably been giving a totally different presentation. I would have stopped here and said, this is what we're looking at, but I'm not. I think there might be a sting in this tale, which I want to come on to a bit later. What the mouse grimace scale does is rescale the visible, effective, and ethical potential between mouse and animal, between mouse and human. And it shows, I think, to adapt a phrase from Myra Hurd, it shows how animals were small like us. And I'm sure I'm not going to be the only person using this phrase today and tomorrow. It's a rather wonderful one. Hurd uses it to prompt our attentiveness to the sociological implications of those species that are overlooked, that we do not consider big like us. And many people have followed this invitation to great effect. But I think it raises another question about the forms of absence that accompany it. What aspects of those animals we assume are big like us are we in fact missing? And why, when, and for whom does this matter? And I think there's a particular issue for this liminal animal like the mouse. As I said, I'd like to have been able to end this story here with the move towards better science, better animal welfare, and the recognition of the role of gender in science, moving together towards a new research horizon, but I don't feel I can. To explain why, I want to pause, retrace my steps a little bit, explain more about what's going on in the scaling of biomedical research using mice, and I want to riff and reformulate Myra Hurd's phrase. Firstly, small like us. Not expecting you to be able to read this, but you can find this sort of explanation of the advantages of the mouse as a model organism in all sorts of biomedical research. And they assume that the mice, in many ways, can be small like us. They're the exemplary mammalian model. This is the case made by the Jackson Laboratory, which has played a key role in establishing and continuing the use of mice in biomedical research. They point to striking similarities to humans in anatomy, physiology, and genetics. They point to the fact that this small mammal is manageable in laboratory settings in terms of cost, space, and time. In addition, they talk about genetic manipulation, the development of tools to alter the mouse's genome. This comes directly from their characteristics as a commensal opportunistic species. Because they're adaptable to high levels of inbreeding, they're ones that you can genetically manipulate. Inbreeding is a problem for many mammals, but not so much for mice. They live in these very high densities occasionally, which means that they're resilient. They carry on breeding in brother-sister matings for up to 20 generations, and at the end of it, you get an inbred strain. An inbred strain is composed then of animals that are genetically identical to each other. You standardize an animal with a different gene to another animal through creating these inbred strains. These points are recapitulated by this interviewee. He cuts to the chase. If you want a mammal, in biomedical research, you use a mouse. More than this, there are the tools, technologies, and infrastructures for working with mice on a large scale. He does a bit of a comparative analysis here. You can argue there's greater variety in Drosophila or zebrafish, but if you take the line that you want to be working with a mammal, then without doubt the mouse is the one that has the greatest number of tools available to it. Inbred mice have been inserted into and become a form of global biomedical research infrastructure. They're now global big biology. So in that sense, perhaps they are big, like us. This is a map of the distribution of the house mouse. Mus musculus originated in Southeast Asia, living as a commensal species in our houses and sharing our food. So they followed us extensively, their distribution largely following our population densities with a few exceptions in the tropics and the Arctic. They can rapidly reproduce when abundant food is available, erupting periodically into huge swarms. They inhabit human history, perhaps, as our animal other. Jonathan Burt's written this wonderful book on rats, which rather unfortunately subsumes the mice, but he talks about how these animals imitate the human's own prodigious appetite. They're like an anti-system, the embodiment of a drive to consume and nothing more. These swarming tendencies have been appropriated, enabling the individual animal to be scaled up as infrastructure. This has happened from certain centres of science. Shown here are the sites that emerge if you map the main laboratories working on mice. It's a network of a concept. This is from biomed experts. Apologies, it's a really rather kind of muddy graphic. But this is where the large concentrations of mice research are. The individual animal is multiplied through these sites in the form of this inbred strain, the one animal's genetic properties extended over time and space through the production of identical animals that can be replicated and allow experiments in different sites to be added together. This circulation then depends on another form of infrastructure, which is the mouse house. The development and circulation of these inbred strains in their transgenic forms has only been possible through the development of individually ventilated cages. This is the environment necessary for the often immunologically compromised animals to survive. The point is that these specialized animals and repeatable experiments introduce the potential to generate large, statistically valid experimental effects. In other words, an inbred mouse in an individually ventilated cage reduces everything else except for that experimental variable. The effect that you see is much less likely to be due to the individual or environmental differences. And this scale has enormous implications for the way that you use the mouse Grimace scale. This scaling up also has implications for the animals themselves. There are emergent properties through these processes that begin to problemize our assumptions of species difference and the way that we infer between animals and humans. This includes the assumption we are any longer dealing with an easily individuated animal being, that they are simply small like us. So I want to argue, let's riff on this phrase again. Perhaps they're big, but not like us any longer. We've created this very strange, very particular form of animal that one animal welfare person talked about as being akin to the Ferrari. In other words, you could only take this on a racetrack. So you have these animals, especially the genetically modified animals, which I tend to think of as being a bit like a Formula One car. Great that they're on that circuit, that really flat level piece of tarmac. You try taking them to go and do the shopping on a Sunday and you're not going to get anywhere. They're suited for that one purpose. But is that really representative of what happens when you get outside of that box? Is a Formula One Ferrari really a car that you can use every day? Now, this rather extended metaphor emerged deep in the middle of a conversation, and I want to try and show you what I'm using it for and what implication it has for what I'm talking about with the mouse Grimace scale. Basically, the inbreeding and infrastructuralization of these animals has created a population that are designed to form a standardized background to show drug and other effects. This inbreeding has influenced their genetic, molecular, and behavioral phenotypes, which impacts the animals and the translation of this research to humans. There are species differences, obviously, that precede this production of animal as infrastructure, including cognitive differences between human and mouse brains. But some of these differences are the direct result of inbreeding. You get a reduction of genetic diversity, meaning that some genes found in humans are entirely missing from these experimental animals. You get a focus on generating animals that express any phenotype early, which means they're not very good as models of aging. Many are blind, deaf, and what scientists would call metabolically moribund by the time they're a year old. The fragility of some of the inbred strains also mean they have to be kept in sterile conditions, which results in different immune challenges and different immune responses. The social behaviours have also been changed by selection and inbreeding. This has produced more docile domesticated animals. But there's also an argument that the genetic standardization has produced animals with an identical scent, something which reduces aggression, but there's increasing speculation about whether the animals can actually differentiate themselves from each other in these cages. So perhaps they don't recognize themselves as individuals. They're kind of big, but not like us. This critique is gathering pace. Mice have formed the basis for the largest set of experimental systems in contemporary biomedical research. But they seem to be appearing to be least like us in the biological systems that we're increasingly most concerned about. And again, this is beginning to kind of filter through in this is from the New York Times, talking about the failure repeatedly of models of sepsis, but then talking about how this is also raising concerns about the modeling of heart disease, cancer, and so on. It's also raising the question about the equivalence of pain in humans and mice and whether the mouse Grimace scale can indicate something that's of relevance to both animals and humans. In short, whilst the mouse Grimace scale may be a good model for human pain research, is it the most relevant indicator of pain for the animal? this is my final iteration, and the answer is probably no. The particular biomedical assemblage of animal and apparatus around the mouse grimace scale has focused on producing this large experimental effect. The effect is real, it's statistically valid, and if you take a large statistically relevant animal population with all the other variables standardized, you do get these facial expressions. The problem is that these facial expressions are not the ones most relevant to the animal. It may be what we see, but it's maybe a form of expression that the animal has been trying to suppress. It's certainly not one that the mice use to communicate with each other. This introduces a potential problem in using it as a measure of animal welfare. The validity of these facial expressions is based on the outcome of experiments with large numbers of animals, sample sizes designed to be big enough to get a result. If you try and use them to assess pain in an individual animal in a different experimental procedure that doesn't want to be observed in the first place, you get a very high risk of a false negative. Add stress to the experimental procedure, and the animals actually demonstrate less pain expression. This is the basis of that argument about stress and gender. What happens when the experiments were repeated in the absence and presence of male researchers was that the scent of the men, whether they were present or whether just their t-shirts were present, increased the animals' stress and suppressed their expressions of pain. The animals may have registered less pain, we don't quite know, but it's difficult to argue this is an overall welfare gain, in that the animals expressing the least pain may also be the ones that are most stressed. Talk to vets and some animal welfare scientists, and a different version of how to look at a mouse emerges. And I'm sure you've all been reading this while I've been trying to go through that. What comes out is, again and again, this term. This is actually about a rat. Sorry, folks, ruled out of bounds, but this thing about being a prey species. And all of these quotes work in a very similar way. It's always somebody somewhere else that notices this, whether it's in Southeast Asia or a farm. There's always this othering of somebody who's not attuned to animal welfare whenever you try and raise these questions. And they're always done in this kind of dialogue sort of way, but I'll read you the first one. This is an older guy who wasn't doing aseptic surgery, and he got right up in my face and said, "Look, let me tell you, honey, rats have this amazing resistance to disease. You don't have to do aseptic surgery on them. They have these amazing immune systems." And I said, "No, let me show you the papers that prove that's absolutely not the case. It's just that the rat is a prey species, and it's not going to show you that it's dying of an infection. It's going to do it quietly and sit there and die of its infection. And you're not going to do necropsy on it. You're just going to say, oops, 20% of my rats were found dead because I'm doing really special research." So there's this kind of false negative risk. And sort of there's a little small element of animal research that already knows this. And I'm sure a lot of us who've ever kept rats or mice or rabbits as pets will know this, that they don't show pain on their faces first. They tend to show them on their hindquarters and their backs. They'll hunch, they'll withdraw, they'll try and make themselves small and kind of disappear from you. And this is some work that's been done on the way people look at animals in laboratories. The experimental animal here was the human. What they did was they used eye-tracking devices to look at people who watched videos of animals potentially in pain. And they tracked how people scanned through the animal's body. They found that almost everybody started with the face and kept returning to the face, which was probably the last place the animals registered their discomfort. So they raise this question, are we looking in the wrong place? So a few conclusions, well, beginning of conclusions. The mouse grimace scale, I think, reflects what's most interesting to us. Our experiences of pain and the primacy of our visual sense. It may be useful in evaluating potential new drug responses in experiments in human biomedicine, but its use in evaluating mice welfare, I think, faces two big issues. The first is this question of species difference, in the way the scale registers animal experiences. As this US animal welfare scientist says, these are animals that live in a different sensory world. It's a world in which they don't want to be seen to be expressing their pain. Secondly, there are statistical differences in the experimental contexts in which this grimace scale is being rolled out. The widespread adoption of it as a scale to recognise and address pain in mice brings with it, as I've said, this large risk of false negative results. In other words, using this scale to say animals are not in pain when they may be, or they may be masking this due to stress, is a particular risk. So I think the mouse grimace scale is turning out to be another fable, a narrative that draws us in with the potential to recognise shared suffering, but may ironically decrease the visibility of animals suffering silently, simply not wanting to be observed. And my kind of transformation in thinking about this has come through some of the conversations I've been having in my work on the Animals in Science Committee recently. And in conjunction with these meetings, I spoke to one scientist who was really sceptical about the mouse grimace scale. He said it simply was telling people what they wanted to hear, backed by the authority of statistically valid science. I want to come on to a few broader conclusions from this in a moment, but I want to kind of pause here to think about the compelling attraction of these sorts of narratives. Why we so wanted to hear the mouse grimace scale? Why did everybody so quickly adopt it? And I think there are maybe things we can learn about what was appealing, what is still appealing about it. They make these animals and these relationships visible. They form a conversation for people from different perspectives. And actually, probably most importantly, they purport to offer a solution that can be easily implemented. Particularly in this making visible and forming a space for a conversation, I really recognise their appeal, and I don't want to argue against all of this potential of working visually and having conversations about this species difference. So I want to kind of, with your indulgence, talk about a couple of images from my own work, which I've always tried to run through sort of ethnographic work on the collaborations between different kinds of mouse researchers with work with an artist, to provide a kind of visual and narrative critique which might function as an alternative gathering place for discussion. And this is mainly through the work with an artist called Helen Skolway. We've collaborated on a wide range of images, and we've also produced a small online archive of works at a site called MySpace. I can't resist puns, it's just not possible. And one of the images which is not on there is this image. And it's true to say that the image we've struggled most to produce is something that's relevant to the mouse's world. We have on our Dropbox a whole folder of experiments under this title, Mouse World. I haven't found the right way of writing about it, and I think it's fair to say that Helen has grappled with different visual approaches in her work as well. This is the first one that Helen produced. And the way we work is that I tend to write, Helen tends to read my writing and produce her own responses before we've had a conversation, but also in connection with her own theoretical commitments. We then have a conversation about them and they get reworked, and we sometimes also take them out for conversation with scientists too. And what you've got here is you've got the statement at the bottom, the difficulty of understanding the mouse's world, and at the beginning you've got this kind of sensory world that's emerging from the mouse's whiskers, which is kind of being pulled mainly by food and sex, it has to be said, but something to climb, possibilities for burrowing, explore this smell, nasty draft, all this kind of thing, which is pushing and pulling on its sensory experiences. And we took it to an animal welfare scientist, and he thought it was really interesting. He liked the mix of text and visual. He thought it would actually be quite good for use in teaching. Its tone emphasizes this mapping. It has didactic qualities. We're kind of realized then that we were falling into exactly the same trap of saying that we could make visible what was important to this animal. And so we kind of gave up for a while and had a lot of conversations and failed. Heroically, we like to think, but... So we kind of went back to this thinking about the animal experience in a different way. And to get away from this idea that to create a visual form of this animal is about making legible, about making visible. These animals are crepuscular, that's it. They like the dark spaces of dawn and dusk. They're thigmatatic, which means that they're very motivated by clinging to edges. They read the density of scents that are laid down in the world. They experience touch through their whiskers. And they also have a sense of magnetism, which orientates them geographically in the world. And none of this material sensory experience is captured by this image at all. So Helen's been doing different things. And this is much more recent. And again, I don't know anything until I get something that comes up and says there's a new image in my Dropbox. And so she and I have been worrying about this kind of question of species being and senses and visuality in parallel, but not always in very close conversation. And I was stunned to see that what she'd been doing was she was trying to produce these visualizations of the mouse's world by blindfolding herself. And she's using graphite powder here to create traces, which are, so she's working on a piece of paper which has a metallic grid underneath, and then she's working over it with her fingers, feeling literally to work out where the sides of the cage actually are. And I think this is a really very interesting and an entirely different approach. If anything, it recalls Eva Hayward's writing about fingery eyes, literally plunging the viewer into these materialized perceptions of animal worlds. It's a much more sensual, material image aesthetically, but I think there's also a darkness to it, which this offer of legibility in the other image just didn't convey. And this sort of darkness, I think, is probably fitting. It points to the impossibility another scientist I spoke to suggests about the situation of the mouse in the mouse house, that we've sought to domesticate a prey species that wants to be in the dark, that doesn't want to be observed, for its scent trails to be disturbed. They don't want to be there, whatever enrichments we may add. That to care about their welfare actually maybe means removing ourselves from this situation. And this is one reason why this particular scientist I spoke to supports zebrafish as a replacement. It's not about sentience and scale. It's because there's... And as many of you will know, there's growing emphasis on fish welfare and fish pain and so on and so forth. His argument, though, is that in the laboratory, the sensory needs of zebrafish are probably easier to meet. And actually, perhaps strangely, this is a similar case for rats. Rats may share many of the characteristics of mice, but they're not only prey, they are also predators. They are more visual animals. They are more interested in exploring. And they're more interested in interacting with people too. So in certain circumstances, something bigger than a mouse may also possibly be considered an experimental refinement too. So I've got three conclusions, and there's a picture. This is what I think a happy mouse looks like. It's alert, it's inquisitive, it's exploring, its whiskers are forward, there's no nose bulge or orbital tightening. But then, you know, what do I know? We don't. So my conclusions are in three different directions, or three related directions. Points about ontology, epistemology, and questions of valuation. These sort of underpin the talk, and I hope will connect to some of the themes in the seminar to come. And I've probably already said it, but it's a conclusion. I have to have one, so I'll say it again. First is about the inextricable enfolding of species being and sensing. Like many others, I've tried to write about scientific practices that explore the permeability between species boundaries, inquiring into the ways human and animal bodies have become unbounded, recombinable in the context of biomedical research and elsewhere. But in this paper, I think what I've tried to do is be more attentive to differences, to the importance of the specific situated experimental encounter and the way we might recognise the limitations, but also engage our own visual acuities in making sense of this. Second point is one about epistemology. There's an unapologetically narrative style in this talk, in part because I want to underline how much these alluring narratives matter to the way that we make sense of our encounters with scientists and other species. In particular, I suggest in this case that when we hear in animal studies, perhaps more generally, what we want to hear, the kind of meaning of the fable is that's precisely the moment to start asking more difficult questions, not to stop. Moreover, I think our questions have to extend beyond what we can say about the moment of encounter to explore how inferences are being made beyond that site-specific experimental protocol and engage with statistics. You know, I think there's a lot about experimental design and statistical inference that's important to the ways that this science is making big claims about big effects that we need to engage with. Finally, then, I want to nod to the sort of political and economic contexts that are important here, but also elsewhere. There are many sites and contexts in which translational research is being materialised in its myriad meanings in contemporary landscapes of biomedicine. The creation of big biology through connecting these small animal geographies is a critical part of this story, but I would also expect to see it elsewhere too. And there's a search particularly here for value, constructed through expansionary experiments, recuperating, exploring the value of this animal's excess, seeking knowledges that can be mobilised in biomedical research. And actually the point I want to make here is that the mobility of these knowledge claims is really the currency, the valency that they have. And by retelling these narratives, by transforming them, by sometimes amplifying them, by attributing our values to them, we're becoming part of the way that those knowledges are mobilised and given precedence. And maybe sometimes we need to be just a little bit more cautious. Though I'll end by saying, please don't stop sending me your mouse stories. I remain fascinated by these processes of what we might call trans-species valuation, how the meanings do change as you move them from site to site, and hopeful that there may be ways of working differently with them. Thank you.
We have 10 minutes or so for questions. That would be fabulous. I'm going to turn the recorder off so you're not quoted in the...